Welcome to Dellingpole, a Breitbart.com podcast. Here is the podcast host, James Dellingpole.
Welcome to the Dellingpole podcast with me, James Dellingpole, and my very special guest, David Goodhart. Now, I've met David a few times in the course of taking part in debates at places like the Durham Union, and I've always thought of David as a mensch, because when I'm with him in debates, I tend to find him simpatico and on my side of the argument. So that's good, isn't it, David?
That is good, yeah. I think I often am on your side of the argument.
Except, by the standards of some of the people on my show, I'd say you're kind of dangerously left-wing. I mean, I mean, for example, you're not Douglas Murray. You're not Katie Hopkins.
No.
I'd put you sort of more in the sort of squishy, soft right centre.
Sensible centre?
Yeah, well, that's how you'd brand it. Tell me about your journey in politics.
I would now describe my politics in the way that the famous American sociologist, was he, or political scientist, Daniel Bell, described his politics. I think this was back in the 1970s. He said, I'm a social democrat in economics. And he was an American, so he basically meant a regulated market economy. I'm a liberal in politics, and I'm somewhat conservative in social and cultural matters. Now, obviously, what being somewhat conservative in social and cultural matters changes a lot over time. I mean, if someone who is conservative on social and cultural matters 30 or 40 years ago would have been hostile to homosexuality, now such a person like me would probably accept gay marriage. So a lot of these things change very rapidly. But I think that's a rather an attractive balance combination. And it's one that, for all sorts of historical and contingent reasons, our party system has never really reflected.
Yeah.
I mean, you might say that there's something of that combination in Blue Labour, there's something of it in Red Toryism. I think it's the hidden majority in our societies, actually. And it's true, I know. I mean, I've come to this more centrist, more small-c conservative view, partly through my interest in immigration, race, multiculturalism. I used to think of myself very much as on the left, or at least on the centre left. I mean, I was a screaming leftist as a student and sort of moved to the...
Well, you were sort of Trotskyite.
Yeah. I mean, my father was a Conservative MP, so I think there is some excuse for being
you
a Trotskyist.
You did it to wind up Dad.
Yeah, and the fact it sounds absurd, but it is actually partly true. I also became a Trotskyist because I didn't get into the Eton College First 11 cricket team.
My jaw was dropping there. So you went to Eton?
Yeah. And I was very, very pleased to read a biography of John Strachey. He was a kind of middle-ranking Labour politician in the Attlee government, but he had been a very important figure on the far left in the 1930s. He was a big figure on the Marxist left. John Strachey, I assume from the great Strachey family.
Strachey, yeah.
Hugh Thomas wrote a biography of him back in the 70s or the 80s. And I was very, very pleased to read, when I read it a few years ago, that he had become a Marxist because he didn't get into the Eton College First 11 cricket team. So there was some...
But this is the thesis of another country, isn't it? The Julian Mitchell play, that the reason that Guy Burgess turned is that he was rejected in some way or other by his posho public school. And so he took revenge on the establishment that had had destroyed him.
Yeah.
So, and you are that person. You are the real latter-day Guy Burgess.
I was just sort of a confused, privileged child who, for a certain period of time, held some idiotic views. And I think, I mean, actually, giving you a little bit of insight into the mentality of... I mean, if you've been a Marxist when you were young, you understand, I think, at least to some degree, jihadism, Islamic extremism, the certainty of knowing the truth about everything around you. You know, when you're a 22-year-old Marxist, part of the attraction is that you have a kind of ready-made family of comrades, and you also have the truth. And one of the positive things about about it is that it makes you interested in everything. You have to know, you know, a little bit about something in order to proselytize the faith.
That's interesting, yes. And also you have to get quite adept at intellectual gymnastics, don't you? Because in order to be able to sort of talk the dialectic, you really have to kind of...
You have to learn how to argue, It's a good mental gymnasium in some ways. I mean, you know, reading Althusser, I remember always thinking it was a bit like kind of doing Latin or Greek. I mean, you didn't understand it, but you sort of... But it was still good mental exercise.
It's not meant to be understood, this stuff, is it? It's a new way of thinking, which denies reality and imposes this narrative on events which are divorced from logic or reason.
Well, obviously they think very differently from that, but it has some of the characteristics of a religion. I mean, in that, you know, you have the original sacred texts, the texts of Marx and Engels themselves, and then all of the many interpretations by different, as it were, scholars over the last 150 years or whatever. And then, you know, you have your kind of priesthood, and you have your senior interpreters of the holy texts, and obviously they think that this does have the, you know, those texts do have the key to reality.
And yeah, they think that, but we know that they don't.
Well, we know that they don't have the key to contemporary reality. I mean, they certainly...
Or past reality. I mean, communism has failed everywhere it's been tried. It's an absolute abomination. Can I just have a brief rant here? The wife and I were coming back from our Pilates class last night, and we were listening on the way back, Faute de Mieux, to Radio 4, who are currently talking about the 1917. And the way that the BBC talks about young Lenin, they would never do with young Hitler. There was this kind of affection
reverence.
For
there
it.
Was a reverence.
It's like, well, you know, he may have made a few mistakes, but he was...
His heart was in the right place.
Yeah. I get angry about that.
Yeah.
Do you not? I mean, do you not reject your past?
I do. No, I mean, I listened to the same programme and exactly the same thought occurred to me. That they... Well, not the point about Hitler so much as the, you know, that the politics that he was developing when he was in London, it was about Lenin in London and the pubs he went to, and it was kind of lighthearted in a way, but it was also about... It kind of completely glossed over the fact that the politics he was developing was extremely authoritarian. It ended up killing millions of people. And I think most scholars now would... I mean, there was a long period, I think, when people tried to protect Lenin from the blame for the terror, for forced collectivization, all these other things. But, I mean, it did flow directly from the party replacing the people, and the party then decides exactly what to do. I mean, and the genocide against the kulaks, you know, a lot of that work would have originated in the work that he was doing that was described in that very radio program, the work he was doing on the land question in the British Museum. Yeah. So he was dividing up the peasantry into, you know, those we could eliminate that probably wouldn't go along with the program and those that should side with the workers' struggle.
So maybe you can tell me, as a reformed leftist, how you justify to yourself, when you're sort of advocating this ideology, how can you live with the violence implicit in everything it does? I mean, Lenin was very much of the view that violence was a very necessary part of achieving his aims. He was absolutely ruthless. So you must have looked at the history and thought to yourself, well, am I really any better than the Nazis?
I mean, it was quite a long time ago, James.
But I didn't go through that phase, David.
No. I mean, I think they were somewhat more violent times. I mean, I'm talking about the late 70s. I mean, not hugely more violent, but somewhat, you know, there was kind of Northern Ireland. There was sort of mass pickets. There were, but I guess the, you know, history has been very violent, would have been the kind of rather smug and silly justification for supporting. I mean, what is ridiculous is supporting violence in a mature democracy, you know, in the name of something that obviously has the support of a tiny proportion of the population, perhaps slightly larger than we thought then, given the election of Jeremy Corbyn. That was the justification. And I remember, you know, the inherent violence, the kind of class violence implicit in everyday life, the fact that people from working class backgrounds die 15 on average, whatever it is, it's actually, the gap has been reduced in the last 30 or 40 years, but, you know, then it would have been, 15, 20 year gap in longevity between classes, or between sections of the people at different ends of the class spectrum anyway. That would have given a sort of a false, I think now, but I mean a false legitimacy to the idea that society is already incredibly violent. Even without people being shot, it's very violent, and it's all right to use force in order to end the current violence, as it were.
Yeah, I can sort of see that. I mean, and what the analogy you used for people who join up ISIS, I think is quite a good one. That you're at an age where you're full of this testosterone and whatever, and you want to kind of express yourself through violence, and you need to find some kind of moral justification for it, and there's your badger if you've got Marxism or Islam. Yeah. So what would you say, given that you've been through this experience, to all those kids now who think that Uncle Jeremy Corbyn is gonna save everything? And you see his kindly bearded face beaming out of photographs, not unlike kindly Uncle Joe smiling benignly over his nation. And there was that thing, was there not, at the peak of the terror, even people who knew on some level that Stalin was responsible for it, at the same time they thought, yes, Stalin cannot know about what terrible things are being done in his name. There was that sort of denial, I think, which is a key part of it, no?
Yeah. I think what I would say to them is you need to, you know, you need to look into your own soul and consider how much of your enthusiasm is kind of cultist, you know, is almost at the level of a cult. If you're intellectually serious, then you need to look much harder at the nature of our society. This really isn't the kind of caricature that is presented by much of the hard left. I mean, just, you know, some of the facts on welfare. I mean, we now spend twice as much of a much bigger cake on social security, on basic sort of pensions and welfare. We spent 7% of GDP back in the supposedly social democratic heyday when I was running around being a silly Marxist. We now spend twice as much. We now spend 14% of GDP on social security. We've invented whole new benefits. Now, I mean, it's true that the welfare system isn't perfect by any means. It's trying to do all sorts of different things, and people fall between the cracks, and we have, you know, whatever it is, a million and a half people using food banks. I mean, we don't live in a perfect society by any means, but the kind of radical, really quite extreme solutions that are being put forward by the kind of momentum Corbynistas, I mean, you know, as you say, they have a track record of not working, and also they are overestimating the violence that is being done to people. I think in today's society, we are a lot richer. We're actually a lot more social democratic in some ways than we were in the 1970s. Another example, I mean, inequality. People bang on about inequality the whole time, reasonably enough. I mean, I think inequality in this country is too high, but actually, income inequality has not really changed since the late 1980s. And what's more, all the main political parties now believe in reducing it. I mean, go back to, I mean, obviously Labour has always been a more equality party. The Conservatives used to believe in a high floor. They were, you know, Margaret Thatcher famously, and I think one of her last speeches in the House of Commons, made the point very powerfully that she did not want to sort of clip the wings of the, of the rich entrepreneur, but she wanted a high starting point for everybody. So she was actually positively hostile to the idea of reducing inequality. Modern conservatives are in favour of it. Now, that's not to say they necessarily put as much policy emphasis upon it as the Labour people do, but there is a huge consensus actually in our society. I mean, this idea of a kind of lurch to the left, I think doesn't really have any foundation, at least not in the socioeconomic stuff. In socioeconomic stuff, if anything, we've seen a convergence between the classes and the value groups over the last 20 or 30 years on, you know, on things like the size of the state and public spending, and indeed the question of equality and inequality. I think it's partly because the middle class has become probably more dominated by the kind of more liberal professional middle class. Sort of the business class probably forms a smaller proportion of the overall middle class than it did 40 or 50 years ago. And the working class has become less statist, less protectionist, partly because it's had to. I mean, the working class has shrunk enormously. It's now probably, I mean, if you mean it in a technical sense of people doing kind of routine and semi-routine occupations, it's now only 20-25% of the population.
Does it even exist?
Well, I mean, it depends. You know, it's a definitional thing, isn't it? Yeah. You know, do you include poor people on benefit? Are they part of the working class? Or is it just people who are at the bottom end of the labour market? Or you could extend it. I mean, if you judge it by self-definition, then on some versions of self-definition, 50 to 60% of the population are still working class. But it depends. Even there, it depends how the question is asked. If you're asked, are you working class or middle class, you get a very high response. 50 to 60% will say working class. If you give people more alternatives than that, it ends up being much smaller proportion. But my point is that where we've seen where the momentum people I think are doubly wrong in that they see a kind of polarization in the socioeconomic sphere, which there hasn't been. If anything, it's the opposite. They are the kind of odd blip that needs to be explained, and I think they can be explained culturally. You know, they are a product, most of them are a product of the rapid expansion of higher education in the last generation or so.
Yes.
In my view, I mean, I've just written this book called The Road to Somewhere, which is partly about the value divides between the people I call the people from anywhere, the liberal, mobile, highly educated people who tend to move away from home. You know, it's part of our residential university. The dominance of residential universities means that to be successful often in this country, to join the professional middle class, means leaving, means, you know, going to live in London or somewhere, one of the great metropolitan centres. And for that reason, the people I call the people from anywhere, who are quite a big, you know, 20-25% of the population, they tend to have a sense of that their identities are so-called sort of achieved identities. You know, they passed exams, they went to a decent university, they have more or less successful professional career. Their sense of themselves is kind of portable, because, you know, they have a kind of sense of being self-invented, and they are, you know, they tend to believe in kind of openness and autonomy, and social fluidity. They're comfortable with social change, and they have weak attachments to group. And to some extent, place. Although they do create their own new places, the Brightons and the kind of parts of Bristol and Manchester, and that they have their own sort of settlements, as it were. Indeed, we saw them emerge very strongly in the last election. The kind of political power of universities, and when we were a bit younger, the university seats meant Oxford and Cambridge.
Yeah.
It's now about 20% of all seats in the country.
We can talk about this more. Yeah. Don't apologise. We can talk about this more in the next section. You're listening to the Dellingpole podcast with me, James Dellingpole, and my very special guest, David Goodhart, author, inter alia, of The Road to Somewhere.
Sunny Johnson brings her cutting-edge conservative commentary to SiriusXM Patriot every week on Sunny's Corner.
I didn't learn conservatism from Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, or Mark Levin. No conservative showed up in my school, my neighborhood, or anywhere in my intellectual orbit. I got all my conservatives from my unknowing but conservative principle practicing family and hip-hop.
Sunny's Corner, every Saturday at noon East on Breitbart News Saturday, SiriusXM Patriot 125.
This is Dellingpole, a Breitbart.com podcast. Here once again is James Dellingpole.
Welcome back to the Dellingpole podcast with me, James Dellingpole, and my very special guest, David Goodhart, author of The Road to Somewhere. Bestseller, I see, from the Sunday Times bestseller.
Well, it crept into the hardback bestseller list for 1 week at number 10.
Nice, but
that means I can stick it on the paperback.
That's absolutely brilliant. I'm happy for you. I mean, obviously, I would have been happier had you been sort of conservative red in tooth and claw rather than sort of squishy conservative. But nevertheless, I'm happy for you because you're a mate. Now, it's interesting that you bring up universities, because I think that academe in both Britain and the US, and certainly in Australia and probably in continental Europe, most of the Western world, is responsible for so much of what is wrong with our culture, in that it has been hijacked by the liberal left. It teaches a form of understanding of our culture which to me is alien and wrong. It's sort of the postmodernist kind of French philosopher nonsensical version of our culture, which teaches us to reject all authority, all established forms, and replace it with, to sort of replace it with a kind of year zero approach. Is that a fair analysis of?
I think there is a problem with the helter skelter expansion of higher education
by Tony Blair.
And even before, but it was they turbocharged it, and I think it has led to the domination of a certain view of the world, which is often quite illiberal, masquerading as liberal. Indeed, one might even say there is a kind of liberal blob that has been promoted by the expansion of higher education, which, as you say, is a sort of it's sort of society is to blame. It's anti-authority of all kinds, pretty much. You know, even as it were, legitimate authority. It tends to see freedom as lack of constraint. I mean, it's a kind of baby. It's a liberal baby boomer. I mean, I went to see the Pink Floyd exhibition at the V&A the other day. One of my daughters took me as a birthday present, and I mean, I was a great fan of the Pink Floyd, particularly. I mean, I thought Syd Barrett was a great hero when I was in my late teens, early twenties. And still do, in a way. I mean, I think he's this marvellous sort of Pied Piper of that generation. But, you know, if you kind of follow the narrative, the kind of, Roger Waters' lyrics, they also, I mean, that whole bohemian culture, that whole liberal culture about, tearing down the constraints of Edwardian Britain, as it were, the focus on kind of mad, and, the kind of Ardy Lang, the straight world is mad, yes. The mad people are sane, all authority is suspect. The awful song, The Brick in the Wall. I was very pleased to see, I met Nick Mason, the drummer, at a education charity dinner not long ago. Catherine Birbal Singh was speaking, and I had a conversation with him about the awfulness of the "We Don't Need No Education" song that they got some kids at some school in Islington to sing.
It was a failing school, wasn't it?
Yeah, and he, I'm very happy to say, was clearly very embarrassed about that. And I noticed in the Pink Floyd exhibition, there is no mention of it at all. I mean, you hear it as you walk past that. I'd already stopped really listening to Pink Floyd at that stage. Is it Brick in the Wall, the album called?
It's called The Wall.
The Wall,
I think.
I mean, I could hear it, but there, virtually every other aspect of every other album was sort of carefully minuted and anything interesting was sort of discussed. So I suspect Nick Mason, who's now got quite interested in education and clearly doesn't believe the lyrics of that ridiculous song, was embarrassed by it. So there was nothing about it, just as there was almost nothing about Roger Waters leaving the band and all that kerfuffle. But that liberal, I mean, that it's a slightly different thing. I mean,
if ever you talk to somebody about Pink Floyd and their references are The Wall, you know that they're not a real Pink Floyd fan because they're the kind of people who, when I was growing up, would have worn stonewashed denim and probably have come from some foreign country like Germany or somewhere. They would like The Wall. But actually, real Pink Floyd fans, they like...
We've given up by then.
Well, yeah. Exactly. You're familiar with Piper at the Gates of Dawn, at least.
Of course, yeah.
You've got Syd Barrett's solo albums.
Of course.
And obviously you think Dark Side of the Moon is probably their finest... My Pink Floyd story is, I'm sure I've told this before on this podcast, but I'm going to tell it again. I once made the mistake of explaining to David Gilmour at a party why it was that in fact their masterpiece was Atom Heart Mother, which I'm very, very fond of. He was quite scornful in his put down.
He really wasn't. I've met him. He's on the party circuit. I've met him at one or two parties too, and I've kind of blathered on about Syd Barrett, much to his and my subsequent embarrassment.
Must be so tiresome for them. Yeah. It's like hello, I have had this conversation with stupid fans before. You realise. Yeah.
The one very good point made by somebody, they had lots of video recordings of people talking about various aspects of the band or their music, and there's a guy called Howard Goodall.
Yeah, the guy who wrote The Snowman, who did a very good TV series about the history of music. He went to my college.
Did he?
Yeah.
He made the very good point that the themes of the dark side of the moon are completely at odds with the music. So the themes are all jagged and about madness and conflict, and the music is all warm and mellow. And I mean, okay, you know, there's a few clanking.
Well,
money is quite disturbing.
But yes, I know what you mean.
But I thought it was a really good point. It hadn't occurred to me before. No. Complete mismatch between sort of form and content. Not form and content, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I rather get that with Radiohead actually, because I'm one of those people who doesn't really listen to bands' lyrics unless there's a particular song that I've sort of become obsessed with, but generally I ignore them because I think, well, then what do they know? They're just bloody pop stars.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the music that matters.
Let's not treat them as artists. I can't bear the way that pop stars are called artists.
Are you with me on that one?
Yeah, absolutely.
God, aren't we snobs? Aren't we the most appalling snobs? Because we went to Oxbridge.
I didn't.
And, oh, you didn't?
No, I went to York.
Oh, my God. Yeah, okay. Yeah, but you went to Eton, which is insane. So you'd kind of been there. You'd kind of been there, done that. Can I just rewind a second, by the way, and have a Jacques Hughes moment? It's not necessary, you know, to go to very good public schools and then sort of shit all over your father's generosity and giving you the best education in the world by becoming an out-and-out Marxist. And I know because I have offspring in this situation, and they're grateful for their education. It really gets on my nerves. Mm-hmm. People whose parents have forked out upwards of $30,000 a year because they care, because they love you, because they don't want you to have the squalor and stupidity of a state education. Mm. And they do it because they love you, and you repay them by rejecting everything that they sent you to the school for.
Well, I think it's probably a way of trying to attract his attention.
Yeah, I see.
I'm one of seven children, so that may be something to do with it. Anyway, he thought it was a complete joke.
How did they? Did you ever let slip in your revolutionary days that you had been to school?
I think I probably covered it up most of the time. Occasionally slipped in.
Did you change your accent?
Oh, of course, yeah.
When you were at school, did you have a posher accent than you've got now?
I don't know, actually. I do remember. It was the time when there was. It was an interesting time. I mean, I was at Eton in the early to mid 70s, and the cultural power had definitely leaked away from the traditional upper middle class, and you know, quite a few kids at the school went around putting on Cockney accents. There were a lot. You know, there was a friend of mine who used to go up to watch Chelsea every other Saturday, and he'd put on the whole kind of bother boots outfit. I mean, there was particularly among the more kind of avant-garde kids, there was the whole, you know, the huge great sort of pop revolution. The prestige and status was all flowing down the other end of the class system, and it was quite interesting sort of experiencing that. And part of that was, and you still see it today, I mean, the kind of Mockney accents of the, the kids that go to Westminster and St Paul's and...
particularly Westminster, my God.
And although perhaps now it's more of a... almost more of a sort of self-protection than being,
sure,
if you talk like Jacob Rees-Mogg. I mean, one of the reasons why Jacob Rees-Mogg is such a sort of national figure, perhaps a little bit like Boris, is that they are seen as such sort of sort of flashbacks in a way, or they belonging to some other era.
Can you move though? I've talked to working class people. I mean, real proper working class people about Jacob Rees-Mogg, and they all say the same thing, which is that we quite like a toff. We quite like somebody who's not embarrassed about it.
Well, I think it's interesting that. I mean, I think it's because yes, I mean, so much of the. So many of the things that have alienated so many people in this country. I mean, I mentioned my book and the value divide. It's a bit simplistic and binary, although there is more light and shade if you actually buy the book, between this anywhere group of highly educated mobile people who basically run our society, and that includes the left. That includes the what we were talking about earlier, the kind of higher education.
So anywheres would be blob. People who went on mass for Tony Blair and people like that.
Could be centre right versions. You know, I don't know, someone who works for McKinsey who. You know, highly educated, very well travelled, perhaps worked in one or two countries, speaks three or four languages, very
Nick Clegg, very free market, very anywhere.
Absolutely, yes. But I mean, you know, there could be people way to his right economically who would also be anywheres. They believe in openness and the European Union and globalisation. Obviously, they've been beneficiaries of it, as well as the left wing professor. A university. I mean, of course, they don't like the fact that they're all part of the same dominant value group, but they are. I mean, they're all in effect.
I prefer to call them disgusting liberal elite, but yeah. but it's the same thing.
They don't even necessarily have to have particularly liberal views. I mean, the McKinsey guy, you know, might even be in favour of capital punishment, but he will certainly be in favour of the kind of openness that benefits the highly educated. You know, he's part of the cognitive elite. I mean, one of the really interesting things, I think, is how both cause and consequence of the massive expansion of higher education has been the way in which one form of kind of human talent, if you like, has become so dominant. I mean, cognitive ability is the gold standard of human esteem now, in a way that I don't think it was really 50 years ago, or certainly not 100 years ago. You know, character, experience, moral virtue. I mean, obviously, these things are not irrelevant now, but they have been demoted in some ways by cognitive ability.
I like that point. A friend of mine who lives near Oxford. We were talking about whether we wanted our children to go to Oxford or not. Not they're going to get the choice, but if they could. And he said to me, I sometimes go and work in the Bodleian, and you really wouldn't want a child to go there. They are all kind of these workaholic little spods. They're all slightly freaky. And you do. Looking at University Challenge, you look at the Oxbridge teams, and they're all a bit weird. They're all a bit funny looking. They've all got sort of tics or yeah, they're a bit strange. Mm.
But we've got unbalanced. I mean, obviously we need, and it may be that technological society like ours perhaps needs even more clever people in the sense of analytical intelligence than we needed 50 or 100 years ago. But actually, in fact, somebody wrote me a letter about my book. Indeed, I borrowed his ideas for a piece I wrote in the Telegraph a week or so ago about this idea. So it sounds a little bit naff, but the three H's, the head, the hand, and the heart. A good society needs a balance between these sort of attributes.
Oh my God! Don't go there. You're sounding like one of those terrible trendy those superheads that comes into a school with three H's. I'm all for
Anthony Seldon.
Anthony Seldon, exactly. I'm all for the academic stuff, and I'm all for the hands stuff. Mm. It's when you start getting on.
Well, okay. Well, actually, to be fair, what he meant by the heart was the kind of emotional intelligence that you require to do caring
to
jobs
be a nurse.
Well.
Yeah.
To be a nurse, and this has been a serious problem that actually. Those sorts of attributes have been undervalued. You know, those, you might say traditional feminine virtues have been undervalued because of the anywheres are overwhelmingly the people of the public realm. They look down upon the private realm, which is why our family policy is essentially about parents being able to spend as little time as possible in the family.
They look down, David, often with very little justification for actually doing so. I mean, most of the degrees that people are studying are absolutely worthless. They're not. I mean, even courses like English, which I did, and I think actually was once quite respectable in teaching you the importance of critical thinking, have now been effectively hijacked by all these kind of Marxist subgroups like feminist studies and so on. I had lunch with my old tutor the other day, and he was saying that if you're a generalist like he was, you know. comfortable with all the whole canon of English literature, you really haven't got a chance of getting a job in academia anymore. They want narrow specialities, and every particular field is colonized by a kind of, you know, a certain interest group which looks after each other. I really worry.
Funnily enough, somebody who I know very well, who was a senior, sort of still is a senior politician, has a son who's just gone to Oxford. He studied history at Oxford, as his son is doing, and he says even the, I mean, much of the time, Oxford, Cambridge, and do seem to be maintaining a standard considerably above the rest of the Russell Group. I mean, one of my daughters went to Bristol. She did history at Bristol. I think she did kind of one essay a month. I mean, I think still at Oxbridge, you have to do an essay a week, and there's a higher workload. But this friend of mine was saying that when he did history, amongst other things, you did the whole narrative of English history, kind of from the Romans to 1950. Now, like everywhere else, you just do two or three modules. Even the elite of the elite have a kind of sense of English stroke British history going back, 2,000 years. No understanding of the kind of arc of history any longer, he was saying anyway. I merely report. But just to get back to the... So we focused a bit on the anywheres and the domination of not just the
university
sector.
I like what you did
sector.
There. I like the way you brought it back neatly to anywheres and somewheres. Yes, okay, yeah.
Well, because we've talked a bit about the anywheres.
But the somewheres who are of great... Actually, you know what we're going to do? We're going to talk about the somewheres in the next section.
Okay.
You're listening to the Dellingpole podcast. I really enjoyed the way that section sort of went into off-piste into Pink Floyd and then back. That was good.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Dellingpole podcast with me, James Dellingpole, and my very special guest, David Goodhart, author, inter alia, of The Road to Somewhere.
Hey folks, I want to tell you about Breitbart News Second Amendment newsletter, Downrange with AWR Hawkins. Features the top gun stories of the week and guest columnists like Larry Pratt with Gun Owners of America or Marty Daniel with Daniel Defense. Each week also features the review of a firearm or a firearm accessory, something to make the exercise of your Second Amendment more enjoyable. You can subscribe to the newsletter for free at Breitbart.com/downrange. It'll show up in your inbox every Thursday.
This is Dellingpole, a Breitbart.com podcast. Here once again is James Dellingpole.
Welcome back to the Dellingpole podcast with me, James Dellingpole, and my very special guest, David Goodhart, author of The Road to Somewhere. David, one of the areas I think where I know we're on the same side is you were a Brexiteer, weren't you? You were for Brexit.
I actually voted Remain.
Did you really?
Mm.
You bastard.
Okay. But I do somewhat regret it now.
But you understand
I'm
why.
Quite enthusiastic about Brexit now.
Are you?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Good man. Yeah. So we love you. See, more rejoicing in heaven. So that's interesting.
Well, it's partly the reaction of the Anywhere Remainers. I mean, they have been so arrogant. They've been, I mean, you know, you probably heard it from various people, you know, people who said they woke up on the morning of June the 24th, this is, you know, Europhile Remainers, and they thought they were living in a foreign country.
Yeah.
Briefly, at least for a few hours.
No, they still
what
think
I want
that.
To say to them is, and, you know, I've got the data in my book, most of the somewhere people in Britain, and indeed more than the somewhere people, I calculate the somewheres, the people who tend to be more rooted, less well-educated, tend to value security and familiarity and tend to have quite strong local and group attachments and often find social change, see change as loss rather than change as something exciting as the anywheres. Anyway, brief description in parenthesis. There are surveys that have been done, you know, opinion polls that have been taken on this very subject, and there is one that's been repeated several times, and it continues to get roughly the same answer. It goes something like this. It is admittedly a very leading question. It's that Britain has changed a lot in recent times. Some people say it feels like living in a foreign country. Do you agree? 63% of the population agree with that. I mean, this is astonishing and depressing in a way for a country that's going to stay basically stable and successful and rich as ours, that so many people feel that. I mean, I don't think they would have felt it 30 or 40 years ago. They do feel it now because of such rapid change in so many ways. And so when I hear these, you know, usually highly educated, very affluent kids saying, oh, I felt like I was living in a foreign country, I just want to say to them, well, two-thirds of your fellow citizens, almost two-thirds, feel that every blinking day.
Yeah.
I mean, and that is one of the big explanations for what has happened. And it is your fault.
Yeah, well, I'm obviously...
Not yours, I mean the imaginary...
I knew you weren't cross with me, even though you were pointing your finger in a stabby way. I knew you didn't mean me. But this is exactly it. I'm probably harsher on these people than you are. I think they're appalling. I think that they are an elite which has looked after its own interests for generations, which saw... in Brexit, the opportunity to pull out the drawbridge once and for all. And instead, they got a very nasty shock when the people were not cowed and actually voted for their own interests rather than that of the elite. And these are people who are not used to losing elections or anything. Yeah.
The extraordinary sense of entitlement of the anywhere class that they are. I mean, I have a spiel about my book, and I've just shown James the kind of the list of the extraordinary degree of anywhere domination of our politics and our policies over the last 25 years.
Tell me a bit about that.
So the economy, we call it the knowledge economy. It's an economy that is designed for the interests of highly educated people. Meanwhile, everybody else, if there is a single reason for the Brexit vote, I would put it down to, if you had to explain it in one sentence, I would say the radical decline in the status of non-graduate employment over the last 20 or 30 years. So the knowledge economy is for the cognitively able, the highly educated. Meanwhile, we have the hourglass labour market for everybody else. So you've got 30-40% of jobs that are highly productive and generally well paid, and not all of them cognitive ability jobs. Actually, it could include working on the production line at Nissan in Sunderland.
This must also be true, by the way, of America and why Donald Trump.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I think this all rich democracies, I think, have been affected. One of the really important things, I think, about... And we don't want to romanticize the kind of the skilled manual manufacturing jobs of old. I mean, obviously they're not coming back, but there was something important about those kinds of jobs, and I think that far fewer of modern jobs have. And that was you didn't have to be highly cognitively able to do those jobs, although you might have been. But what you did need was a lot of experience to do them well. I mean, to do certain kinds of those sort of technical manual operating jobs in a factory, you didn't get good at it until you'd been doing it for 2 or 3 years, and that provided you with protection. It provided you with status protection. It meant that somebody, a double first from Cambridge, could not just walk in off the street and do that job. So, and I think we've lost a lot of those kinds of jobs. So a lot of people, I mean, I think what 85-90% of jobs in Britain now, you either have to have a university degree to do, or you can learn how to do it in about half an hour. It's those sort of middle status, middle income jobs that have disappeared in such large numbers. Then, of course, in education, we've seen the more or less mono track. You know, if you're a school leaver, you should have three decent options: higher education, some kind of technical, vocational. Next stage of education, or straight into an apprenticeship in a local office or factory, and in effect, we've only had one. We've only had the university. I mean, the massively more subsidised, even with tuition fees, massively more subsidised, massively more clearly signposted. Of course, all the teachers who have been down that route themselves are pushing everybody in that direction. But still, only 40% of our kids go down that route. There's still 60%.
My son was travelling around Bulgaria recently, and he met with all sorts of people. And one of the people he met was this electrician, sort of middle-aged electrician. And he said, listen, don't go to university, mate. I will train you up to be my apprentice. You will make so much more money. We are coining it in because no one wants to do it. No one wants to get their hands dirty. No one wants to learn the skills. Jobs like that.
No, absolutely, yeah. They're still there. You know, the hand jobs we still desperately need. And just to give you an example, I think we had last year we had 8,000 people starting construction apprenticeships. We're meant to be building, 200,000 houses a year? Meanwhile, a third of the building workers in London are born abroad. I mean, it's just, even in the short term, it is kind of idiocy the way that we've overexpanded a certain kind of higher education. I mean, I'm not saying, you know, I don't necessarily want fewer people to go into higher education. I just think it should be much more sort of diversified, and we should have a much higher technical element to it. I mean, this is an old problem in Britain, obviously, that for various reasons, the technical and the vocational has carried less prestige than it has done in Germany, say. And we make attempts. I mean, we're sort of making one at the moment to do kind of handbrake turns on this. We've now got an apprenticeship levy. We have these T levels and so on. But it all feels a bit token, really. And there's something deep in our culture that, and it's been reinforced by anywhere domination. Because of course, all the anywheres have been to Russell Group universities. Their children go there. It's a world they understand. It's a world they dominate. So they just said, well, let's massively expand it and send as many people as possible there. Just on some of the other things that illustrate anywhere domination, obviously there's the economic openness, represented both by the EU and the WTO. I mean, globalization, people talk about free trade as if it doesn't come with any costs. It comes with massive costs to our politics. And indeed to our kind of national life in some ways, which is not just, you know, it may be the balance is positive. And
you mean
it should open up.
If you outsource manufacturing jobs to the Chinese, that kind of thing.
There is the double whammy of, you know, you lose your factory goes to China, and then a whole population of workers is imported to compete with you in the non-traded sector.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a new thing. I mean, but that's exactly it. I mean, that we, as a result of open trade openness, some of it EU, some of it WTO as well, we're not allowed to have our own immigration policy. Obviously, we will now after Brexit. We're not allowed to have our own industrial policy. We can't take our own national decisions on these crucial areas of risk. Different countries have different attitudes to risk. So we're prepared to take a higher level of risk, say, than the Germanic countries on financial products or, you know, GM crops and things like that. You know, we tend to worry less about them than other countries. And you end up, both in kind of WTO and EU regimes, that they squash all these things. So countries are sort of denuded of their traditional sort of collective cultural choices. Obviously, there are internal divisions within countries too. I mean, it's not always completely clear, whether the majority would be, or there may be a very loud minority that are against GM crops and so on. But still, most of these things are still things that we sort of instinctively feel should be decided at the national level. But because of the level playing field that is required by free trade arrangements, all of these things have to be suppressed, essentially. And of course, free trade has hugely increased human wealth, but you know, we're getting to a point now where it is interfering in such a direct way with our sense of control. I mean, the other thing about modernity and democracy is it's meant to be about having some control over both your kind of individual and your collective life, or at least more control than your parents or grandparents or great grandparents would have had. And yet we're taking away that control. You know, we're sending it upstairs to all these international organizations. Now, a lot of the anywheres, they understand it. They may, you know, they kind of probably know somebody who might work for one of these bodies, and they're relatively comfortable with it. Non-elites just see this as a complete loss of control, and it hasn't been explained to anybody. You know, the anywheres have been very, very lazy in the way in which, partly through moral self-righteousness, because all of these things have also been associated with greater openness, high levels of immigration, greater mixing of peoples, you know, all of these things that are regarded as sort of unequivocally good things. So they've got a sort of moral self-righteousness when they talk about pushing things upstairs and moving things. And of course, the nation state has come out of the 20th century, or at least the first half of the 20th century, with its reputation, you know, seriously damaged, which is why the EU is as much a religion as it is a system of power and economics. It's a religion, and we've never been full believers. We probably moved from being agnostics to now being atheists. So we're not in the church really, because of our history. We don't, you know, we haven't needed it in the way that, you know, France, Germany, Italy, Spain have needed it. You know, coming out of dictatorship and destruction and so on. But there are other things too. I mean, the way the technocratic state, you know, takes things out of the democratic conflict. You know, the independence of the Bank of England. I mean, just in the last 20 years, we've had independence of the Bank of England, huge increase in judicial activism, all the kind of human rights, sort of anti-majoritarian stuff in law, and then of course all the EU legislation, which prevents us increasing VAT or reducing VAT on food or whatever it is,
or tampaxes,
exactly, yeah. But now, all you know, you may argue about it, may be right, but the independence of the Bank of England may be a good thing. So, but what you can bet your bottom dollar, when things are taken out of the democratic contest, they will be decided according to what I call, you know, anywhere priorities and intuitions.
You mentioned the Bank of England, and here we are in Policy Exchange, which is the think tank you work for, which I think of as dangerously pinko centrist. But on the wall, I saw a picture of one of the people I hate more than anyone in the world, and that's Mark Carney. Now, Mark Carney, it doesn't really matter whether the Bank of England is independent or not, because Mark Carney is so much part of the globalist elite. He's so much Davos man that the way he thinks is the same way as David Cameron thought, the same way as George Osborne thinks, the same way as the GOP establishment in America thinks, the same way as the Democrats think, the same way everyone in the European Union thinks. There is this global class, the anywheres that you talk about, which have so dominated our culture that I wonder whether the little people, the people like me, who came out of our caves and voted for Brexit because it's what we believed in sovereignty and stuff. I wonder whether the system is going to crush us. Where are you on this one?
No, I don't think the system. I mean, I think we will have a Brexit. I do think.
Yeah, but will it be a watered down Brexit?
I think we have shifted slightly from a kind of somewhere Brexit that emphasised ending freedom of movement and full judicial sovereignty and so on, to something that perhaps a little bit more of an anywhere Brexit, which still accepts Brexit. They kind of accept that that was the albeit small majority decision. But I think it will happen. I mean, my worry is that we will. All the focus has been on apparently the confusion on the British side, and I think the Conservative Party, to its credit, is sort of having slightly kind of behind the scenes. It's having a kind of national debate about what Brexit should be. After all, the referendum.
Why to its credit? We decided. We knew what we wanted.
Well, no,
we
no,
wanted
no,
to
we
end.
Didn't,
we didn't.
No,
we
no,
wanted to leave
huge.
The single market. We wanted to stop freedom of movement.
Yeah.
Duh.
Yeah.
There was no question about it. The only question has to do with whether or not we get Brexit, but what Britain does as a country, what it does with its freedom, which is a completely separate issue. It's not about.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it's quite as simple as that. I mean, I don't think, you know, we voted to leave the European Union. I mean, there are lots of different forms of that leave could take. But I think there is a pretty strong consensus. I mean, there's a very strong consensus, I think, on leaving the single market. Very strong consensus on ending freedom of movement. Perhaps slightly less strong on leaving the trade.
Well, the customs union.
The customs union. Yeah, I mean, but I think we will do that too.
It.
No, they're having this debate sort of more or less in the open. I mean, the Labour Party is sort of sniggering from the sidelines and not really taking part at all. At least the Conservative Party are sort of having the debate, and we are edging our way towards some sort of compromise on that. I don't think it'll be one that you have to worry about too much. But I think I think if the negotiations fail, I think there is quite a strong possibility they will. And I think the demonstrable responsibility for that will be with the EU side. I mean, we forget, I mean, one of the reasons, indeed, we're leaving the European Union. I mean, the European Union was the most extraordinary success story for the first 50 years of its life. I mean, it hugely, up until the Maastricht Treaty, into the early 90s, the formation of the euro along political rather than economic lines, that was really the beginning of the end, I think, for a properly functioning European Union. It worked pretty well. Indeed, it hugely outstripped expectations. In the last 20 years, most of the big projects that it has touched haven't worked or haven't worked well. I mean, whether it's the euro, enlargement was done far too rapidly. I mean, that was partly our fault. We were the people that were promoting enlargement more than anyone else, partly because we wanted to dilute the integration forces. But yes, one of the main reasons we're leaving is because of enlargement, because of the extra costs of it, which allowed the 350 million a week. It may be an exaggeration, but I mean, we have ended up paying a lot more in as a result of enlargement, and of course freedom of movement. Those two things combined are probably the two biggest reasons for us leaving. But then look at the refugee crisis, look at the mishandling of the Ukraine crisis, the car emissions. I mean, all of these sort of second order things. So I mean, I think we kind of sit here thinking, you know, sniggering at our own politicians. If it doesn't work, and I think there's a good chance it won't, it'll be because of the EU. I think they will screw it up because they have screwed up so much in the last decade or two, couple of decades.
Can I, before we come to the end, go off to our next thing, where we've got to go on the BBC World Service with the communist Abby Wilkinson. That'll be a laugh. Was the thing that red-pilled you, as it were, the immigration issue? Because you mentioned it briefly earlier, and I was thinking Nick Cohen, another man of the left, possibly more left than you, I don't know.
Yeah,
about the set, yeah. But I think Nick is one of the very few people on the left who's realised actually there is no compatibility between the values that made me a lefty and this kind of unholy alliance that the left has with jihadists and the way that they are destroying working class communities through unchecked immigration. Is that something that really pushes your angry buttons?
Well, in a way, yes. I mean, I think the inability of anywheres to actually be genuinely liberal and pluralistic and see that even if they don't feel it, I mean, you know, partly because of the life that the modern anywhere lives, which is a very mobile one. They don't tend to have very strong roots or the group attachments that they might have had, whether national or you know, just to sort of people like us from around here kind of attachments. They don't really have them, and they don't understand and therefore rather look down upon and are far too ready to see as xenophobic the kind of group attachments that most people still have. And those group attachments are very easily disturbed. I mean, I talked about the kind of achieved identity of anywheres. Well, most somewheres have what one might call ascribed identities, so that it's mainly, you know, their sense of themselves still comes from, you know, where they live, the group they belong to.
But also things like small details. The thing about England is that you can travel from Manchester to Liverpool, which is what? It's a very short distance. It's
25 miles.
25 miles. The accent is completely different. Mm. The traditions are completely different. Mm. The sense of humour is different. And you can say,
which is why it was very controversial. Andy Burnham, who comes from Liverpool, became the mayor of Manchester, Greater Manchester. I mean, it was a serious. Anyway, yeah, because I'm just supporting your point.
He's an anywhere man, if through and through, isn't he? But you're right that this attitude of the liberal elite, the anywheres, towards people who have loyalty and fondness of their local communities and their traditions and customs and their accents, which are detectable in tiny nuances in the way people behave and the way they talk, they're rejecting actually the very thing that makes us English, aren't they?
Yeah, and of course they. You know, the whole multiculturalism thing in the 70s and the 80s was about recognizing ethnic traditions, just ways of life for minorities, and saying that societies like Britain should accommodate these differences. But it was, but it.
That's no. That's what it claimed.
But
to
when
be
it
about.
Came to the majority ethnicity, yeah. It was as if majority ethnicities don't have an ethnicity. They don't have traditions and ways of life that they will also want to preserve up to a point. No, and we have to find a way of making, you know, in communities and neighbourhoods, making the people from the majority community feel secure, as well as, you know, providing a space for our now quite large minority populations in many of our big cities to also feel that they have a kind of stake and a in the society. And we've been very one-sided about that. And I think particularly there has been anywhere hypocrisy. They've, like I say, I have this phrase. I describe the politics of at least most somewheres. I mean, there are xenophobes and authoritarians, but I think most somewheres are what I call decent populists. So they've actually gone along with quite a lot of the great liberalisation of the last 40 years on race, on sexuality, on gender, and but they are not liberals. You know, they still believe in the nation state. They still believe in. They have a kind of gut sort of attachment to the main social norms of the society, yeah. and they're anxious about high levels of immigration. They're anxious about the integration of minorities. You know, they're anxious about. You know, the welfare state no longer being mainly contributory and welfare free riding and they kind of they feel it and they feel community in a way I think that many anywheres don't.
They get told by Baroness Nugent that when they fly the cross of St George right. outside their
yeah.
house,
yeah, that's an illegitimate attachment. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
But they're not. You know, I mean, I think most of them are have basically decent views that group attachment do not necessitate hostility to others. I mean, if you go back to the 50s and 60s, you know, we were a pretty racist society. And then I think group attachment did often involve hostility to the other, the unfamiliar. You know, Britain had been a very homogeneous society, and very relatively small proportion of the population had had anything to do with the empire and colonies. You know, people talk about how this is you know, you know, people coming here was some sort of revenge for colonialism. Very few English and British people had very much to do with it, but there was hostility. There was a sort of a shock to the system in those relatively small number of places where you got large numbers of post-colonial immigrants coming. But we got over that, and they became part of our society. They've been absorbed into it. They're now a familiar part of the British story. But then we got the second great post-war wave of immigration starting in 97, and the numbers have just been historically unprecedented, and the change has been far too rapid, and people have objected to that, you know, in a pretty mild way. The politicians have generally ignored it. The numbers have gone up and up and up. It's obviously one of the other factors behind the Brexit vote. But people are not... I think, you know, you can see, I mean, the number of people who, admittedly, they're being asked to judge their own feelings, but the people who admit to being very prejudiced in our society, according to the latest BSA figures, is 1%. Now, there's a much larger group who do admit to being a little bit prejudiced, as almost everybody is prejudiced in some sense, they're probably just being more honest. But, I mean, people want, you know, stable communities, relatively secure borders. They're not hostile to all immigration, but they want relatively modest levels of immigration. They want citizens' rights before universal rights. And they want, you know, particularly if they come from the bottom half of the social and economic spectrum, they want a narrative and structure for people who don't flourish in graduate-dominated economies. These are not big asks.
No, they're not.
And they have been largely ignored by the anywhere political class
yeah.
in the last 20 years, and hence Brexit.
Yeah, hence Brexit. Well, we'll bring it to an end there. You're listening to the Dellingpole podcast with me, James Dellingpole, and my very special guest, David Goodhart. Thank you and goodbye.